Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. Dr. John Kunkel makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I think this is the second occasion you've addressed us, but on this time on a different topic to last time. And the topic for tonight's talk is Whatever Happened to Economic Reform, a Gen X Reflection. I'll introduce John Kunkel very briefly. Educated at the University of Queensland, took his PhD at the Australian National University. He worked at the Reserve Bank. He then worked for John Hewson as a staffer. He worked for us, highly regarded, at the Sydney Institute for some years. And then he moved to Canberra, where he worked on the staff for the Trade Ministers Tim Fisher and Mark Vowell, and then as a speechwriter for John Howard. And currently, John Kunkel is Deputy Chief Executive at the Minerals Council of Australia, and talking tonight on Whatever Happened to Economic Reform, a Gen X Reflection. John, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Minerals Council of Australia, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Eora people, and specifically the Gadigal, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. I've called this address a Gen X reflection, in large part because for this generation, born between 1965 and 1980, economic reform has been the dominant issue in Australian public life. First, under Bob Hawke and Paul Keating, then under John Howard and Peter Costello. My other generational starting point is to suggest that views on politics and policy tend to crystallise in the early years of adult life. For old Gen Xers like me, those years were the early to mid-1980s. By extension, the political coming of age of young Gen Xers corresponded more or less with the economic reforms of the early Howard years. I turned 17 on the day Bob Hawke was elected in March 1983. I wrote a final year high school essay on Hawke's economic summit, was fascinated at university by the battle between wets and dries in the Liberal Party, and went on, as Jared said, to work at the Reserve Bank and for John Hewson, then Shadow Finance Minister, prior to joining the Sydney Institute as an economist towards the end of the decade. To Jared and Anne, it's great to have the opportunity to address the Institute a second time, 20-odd years since I last worked in the dungeon downstairs. For a long time, I resisted the conclusion that Australia had lost its economic reform mojo, that the legacy of individuals, ideas and institutions which propelled structural or microeconomic reform, the thing Paul Keating famously said the resident galah in every pet shop was talking about in 1989, had fallen into serious disrepair. Now I think there's too much evidence to ignore. After roughly two decades of successful reform, Australia has lost its touch and in some areas gone backwards. I don't pretend this is a remarkable insight. Others have made the same point. Tonight I want to discuss the underpinnings of successful economic reform and by extension suggest what has afflicted pursuit of a coherent productivity-raising reform agenda more recently. My reform model boils down to three P's: paradigm, politics, and process. Get them right, and the rest will largely take care of itself. Get one or more of them wrong, and things start to sag. By understanding what we once got right, we can hopefully identify the preconditions for righting the reform ship. In this context, I want to examine the recent contribution to the economic reform debate by Professor Ross Garnaut, a giant of the reform era. If I were to summarise the Garno thesis, it's that the biggest obstacle to public interest economic reform in Australia today is the power of private vested interests, including the mining industry. Such interests, Professor Garno argues, have basically torn up the old rule book, whereby pursuit of private interests in the public square was muted or constrained. The implication is that policymakers should be more insulated, if not isolated, from business and community groups, and take their reformist cue from a chosen few. I'll argue that the Garno thesis is both unconvincing as history and flawed as political economy, if the goal is durable economic reform in the national interest. So a potted history of economic reform over the last three decades goes something like this. Australia's march toward a more market-oriented economy had some fits and starts in the 1960s and 1970s, but momentum really developed under the Hawke government, elected in 1983. By the early 1980s, poor productivity, a deep recession, and falling terms of trade had signified the exhaustion of the old economic regime. This regime was highly regulated, anti-competitive, and redistributive. Its founding articles of faith were high protection, the White Australia policy, and centralised industrial relations. Gerard Henderson's Federation trifecta, later expanded by Paul Kelly into the Australian settlement. Under Hawke and Keating, Australia started down the road of pro-competitive structural reform of capital, product and labour markets, beginning with the floating of the dollar in December 1983. This was followed by a significant liberalisation of the finance sector, including the removal of exchange and interest rate controls, although, as Ian McFarlane pointed out in his Boyer lectures in 2006, important reforms were undertaken by John Howard from the Campbell Committee inquiry. Trade reforms were introduced initially on an ad hoc basis, industry by industry, but in 1988, the Labor government introduced the first in a series of phased reductions in tariffs across most industry sectors. Critical support for unilateral trade reform came from parts of business which were large net losers from the protection all-round racket, in particular the mining industry and broadacre farming. With the 1991 tariff cuts, protection was heading down to levels last seen at the beginning of the 20th century. Increased external competition led to inevitable pressures for reductions in input costs, notably in labour markets and high-cost public utility services like power, transport and communications. Flexibility in wage determination was introduced initially under the Keating government and extended by the Howard government after 1996. The early to mid-1990s witnessed an increasingly broad-ranging microeconomic reform agenda, best illustrated by national competition policy, whereby all Australian governments undertook a coordinated program of reforms to infrastructure services, government businesses, and anti-competitive regulation. State Liberal governments were important co-authors of these reforms. While my focus tonight is on microeconomic or structural reform, I should stress that macroeconomic reforms, improved monetary and fiscal policy frameworks were key elements of Australia's new economic model. Inflation targeting was begun under Labor and formalised by Howard and Costello. The Howard government's fiscal reforms, debt reduction and the Charter of Budget Honesty further moved Australia towards best practice macroeconomic policy frameworks, with the milestone also of efficiency-raising tax reform. Together, these reforms laid the basis for Australia's economic renaissance, following decades of relative economic decline. Underpinning this economic revival was a surge in productivity growth in the 1990s. Productivity growth averaged almost 2% a year, more than double the previous rate. Australia's economic performance also improved relative to other developed countries, reversing a long-established pattern. Having slipped from fifth in the world in terms of GDP per person in 1950 to 15th in 1988, Australia saw its international per capita ranking recover to around 8th by the early 2000s. Hence, the dividends of reform were reaped via improved productivity and higher living standards. By the start of the millennium, Australia had taken on the mantle of a miracle economy, managing to avoid recession through the Asian financial crisis, the United States tech wreck, and the international recession of 2001. Since then, as we know, our living standards have continued to grow. Indeed, the noughties have seen a further period of uninterrupted economic growth. But underpinning higher prosperity has been higher commodity prices, not higher productivity. Indeed, the decline in our productivity and the rise in our terms of trade between 2003 and 2011 were almost equally unprecedented. Australia's mediocre productivity performance in the noughties has corresponded with a marked slowing in the pace of structural reform. That's not to deny that at least some of the forces contributing to lower productivity may be temporary. Nor do I pretend that the reasons for waning reform enthusiasm are anything other than complex. Indeed, there's a reasonable case that the job has become harder in some ways. In part, this is the low-hanging fruit theory, that by the 1980s, policy distortions were so great that Australia was simply catching up with trends in other developed countries. Related to this is the truism that you can float the dollar or cut tariffs only once, then it's done. Similarly, one could argue that the remaining structural policy challenges are more wicked. Either they are institutionally more complex, cutting across the Federation with more and more stakeholders, or they are intrinsically more problematic. The obvious example here is climate policy, where anything Australia does alone has minuscule impact on the environmental problem, but potentially significant negative impacts on our economy. However, this doesn't explain the pattern of reform backsliding over recent years. We have seen at least the partial restoration of anti-competitive regulation across a range of policy areas. Examples include industry assistance policies, where the Productivity Commission has been deliberately sidelined for political reasons, more permissive anti-dumping laws, protecting less competitive firms at the expense of local user industries, new sector-specific laws and regulations impeding competition in markets for coastal shipping, building and construction, and telecommunications, new bureaucracies created to parcel out green subsidies and pick low emissions technology winners, new bureaucracies created to monitor and regulate private sector purchasing decisions on major projects, and new workplace laws, the defining characteristic of which is the revival of trade union privileges when trade unions represent around 13% of the private sector workforce. A number of these measures have found support across the political spectrum. The net result is a widening gap between the rhetoric and reality of structural reform in Australia. So what explains this decline in Australia's reformist credentials? To help us understand this question, it makes sense to seek lessons from the earlier successful reform era. Interweaving the reform fabric, giving it both strength and consistency, were a number of threads. They boil down, in my mind, as I said at the outset, to the three P's: paradigm, politics, and process. By paradigm, I mean simply that successful structural reform begins with clear thinking and clear language. Australia's reform heyday was hard-headed in its recognition that productivity growth relied on more efficient production methods within firms and better allocation of resources across industries. Microeconomic reform has two characteristic features: the sharpening of incentives to be more productive and the provision to firms of greater flexibility to adapt to change. Or to put it in Keating speak, we've got to clear all the bloody crap from the pipes. We're blowing out the pipes. Unfortunately, the use of the word reform from an economic perspective has become so elastic and debased as to be almost divorced from this historical understanding. As Gary Banks observed in his final speech as chairman of the Productivity Commission, almost any policy proposal having an economic dimension has tended to be portrayed as pro-productivity, whether that is the case or not. As a consequence, the public has become confused or bemused, making it difficult to build support for policies and reforms that really would make a difference. Now, often reform has been deemed synonymous with spending more money. At times, it has been applied to measures which run directly counter to a traditional focus on removing policy distortions and increasing structural flexibility. In short, we've let the crap build up in the pipes again. If the thinking of our leaders on economic reform is muddled, or worse, deliberately misleading, is it any wonder that the pace and quality of reform have both suffered? The second P is politics. Successful economic reform may well hinge on sound economics, but it is quintessentially a high political art. There is simply no substitute for politicians owning the reform challenge, working out the trade-offs, understanding the detail, and explaining the measures day in, day out, to the wider community. From Hawke and Keating to Howard and Costello, the pattern, albeit with backflips and blind spots, was remarkably similar, aided by good quality advice from the public service, a knowledgeable policy community, and a broadly supported press corps. Somewhat cheekily, Peter Costello, on the occasion of the 30th anniversary of the Industries Assistance Commission, the forerunner to the Productivity Commission, reminded the audience that it was not the economists in government or universities who made changes in government policy, it was the politicians. The same story applies elsewhere. As Henry Ergas has observed, all the developed world's great economic reformers, whether you're talking about Roger Douglas, Paul Keating, Nigel Lawson or others, were first and foremost politicians. The track record of alternative approaches to reform is decidedly more mixed. Arguably, Australia's recent experiences on carbon pricing and taxation reform have run into problems not because politicians intruded too much. Rather, the political calculation to elevate non-politicians as high-profile figureheads proved questionable as a strategy for successful reform. Or as someone steeped in the reform era put it to me recently, the model of economist as rock star has failed. The third key ingredient of successful reform is good process. Good process encompasses establishing the need for reform, communicating the problem, understanding possible remedies, and building political support for change. The proposed solution then needs to be analysed and tested through extensive and meaningful consultation, not least with those most directly affected. This reflects much more than governance imperatives in a democratic system. It reflects the recognition that knowledge is dispersed, that technocrats don't have all the answers, that there are lessons to be learned from those outside government. Yes, this takes time, but far from encumbering reform momentum, effective consultation has been shown to improve the prospects for durable reform. Contrasting experiences can be seen most starkly in the respective fates of Howard-era policies on tax reform and work choices. In the area I have some involvement with, resources taxation, the very different processes which surrounded the Hawke government's petroleum resource rent tax and the resource super profits tax capture the point well. From an institutional perspective, the Productivity Commission and its predecessors have provided the benchmark for good process on economic reform. Consultation is viewed by the Commission as integral to its business model, not a discretionary activity. It doesn't matter how many PhDs an institution has. Complex tasks should be approached with humility. Good process, ultimately, is good economics and good politics. For those who think I'm merely echoing the views of those who pay my salary, I would point to the comments of Ted Evans, Ken Henry's predecessor as Secretary of the Treasury. He observed in early 2010, prior to the release of the Henry Tax Review, that, and I quote, consultation with stakeholders is a critical issue, as Canberra does not have practical, hands-on experience of commercial operations, and such knowledge is critical to good tax system design." Unquote. Herein lies an important yet under-remarked cleavage in our reform-minded policy community. On the one hand, there are those whose support for market-oriented reform is shaped and conditioned heavily by an understanding of the limits of human knowledge, including of so-called experts. This essentially Hayekian perspective views reform, at least in part, as an open-ended process where competing interests, ideologies, and passions are weighed and assessed. From this standpoint, consultation may be long and tedious, but it is critical to ensuring the relevance and integrity of policy advice. It is part of how policymakers learn. The alternative view, also grounded in economics, proceeds from a rather different worldview. It embodies what has been called the benevolent dictator school of welfare economics. It tends to put much more faith in technocratic experts and their capacity to identify the one true path of reform. By inclination, it takes a decidedly dim view of the involvement of commercial society in the policy process, looking where possible to insulate policymakers from those with practical hands-on experience of commercial operations. This dichotomy, I believe, helps us in thinking about some recent contributions to the debate about economic reform in Australia, its past achievements and contemporary ailments. One high-profile contributor has been Professor Ross Garnaut, formerly Bob Hawke's economic advisor and more recently author of the Garnaut Climate Change Review commissioned by Kevin Rudd and expert advisor to the multi-party Climate Change Committee established by Julia Gillard. As I said earlier, Professor Garnaut is a giant of the reform era. His understanding of Australia's economic challenges and his policy advice contributed significantly to the pursuit of internationally oriented reform by the Hawke government, notably the floating of the dollar and tariff cuts. I should emphasise that I'm not contesting tonight the thrust of Professor Garnaut's economic analysis as laid out in his 28 May lecture, Ending the Great Australian Complacency of the Early 21st Century. Nor do I contest his theme that the long boom has engendered policy complacency. On a personal level too, I should say that Ross was one of my advisors at the Australian National University. He was always thoughtful and courteous in that role. Where I part company with Ross is around his reading of recent events and the implications he draws, both positive and normative, regarding the Australian reform story. To be sure, he makes cogent points about the importance of political leadership. One of the two leaders he particularly mentions, in fact, Bob Hawke for charisma, are Bob Hawke and Joe Lyons. And of course, Anne's book is the definitive work on Joe Lyons. But the nub of the Garnaut thesis is that policy change in the public interest has become more difficult over time, and I quote, "as interest groups have become increasingly active and sophisticated in bringing financial weight to account in influencing policy decisions," unquote. Among examples cited in this context are the union campaign against the Howard government's industrial relations reforms, business campaigns against climate change policy reform from 2008 to 2011, the mining tax campaign of 2010, and the gambling industry's campaign on poker machines reform in 2012. Such groups, he argues, have come to feel less inhibition about investment in politics in pursuit of private interests. Garnaut attributes this to a weakening of ideological and social constraints arising from pre-capitalist moral impulses, which, he argues, had previously checked the pursuit of self-interest in the public square. Here he assembles a supporting cast comprising Max Weber, Fred Hirsch, author of the 1970s book Social Limits to Growth, and contemporary economists Joe Stiglitz, Paul Krugman and Jeffrey Sachs. As Albert Hirschman has shown, Professor Garnaut's ideological formation is simply a modern take on the old idea that the market and capitalism harbour self-destructive proclivities, one with antecedents in both conservative and Marxist thought. It runs counter to the more benign view drawn from the Scottish Enlightenment, whereby the likes of David Hume and Adam Smith saw the spread of commerce and industry as a powerful moralising agent and source of moderation, including in relations between states. In an Australian context, lamenting the lack of examples where private interests have been asked to accept private losses in the last dozen years, Professor Garnaut suggests that, quote, when asked, the response has been ferocious partisan reaction rather than contributions to recent discussion of the public interest in change and in the status quo. He appears to view the miners' campaign of 2010 as Exhibit A of uninhibited private interest pressure on the policy process. To my mind, the Garnaut thesis has some serious flaws. Firstly, I find the claim that Australian public policy has reached some type of tipping point based on interest group politics unpersuasive as history. Policy making in most democratic societies at most times is conducted within a swirling mix of interests, ideology and passions. The very nature of democratic politics is the peaceful reconciliation or resolution of competing interests. One can think of policy battles no less willing than those of recent times when private interests have mobilised resources and the latest communication techniques in promoting an alternative view of the public interest. The campaign by private banks against the Chifley government's nationalisation crusade in the late 1940s is an obvious example. My own view is that the banks were on the right side of the argument and of history. Moreover, the whole edifice of protection all round in Australia would seem to have been based on industries and unions using the political process to pursue private interests. How this was restrained by Protestant social norms or other pre-capitalist moral constraints is not entirely obvious. As to the 2010 mining tax dispute, the suggestion that the mining industry rejected with ferocious partisanship a, quote, reasoned discussion of the public interest, unquote, is, not to put too fine a point on it, nonsense on stilts. The industry took a constructive approach to the Henry Tax Review, conceptually in its public submissions and in offering to share with the review both detailed commercial data and modelling. The official response was stony silence. No reasoned discussion of the public interest was ever offered. In the event, a complex and punitive tax which couldn't be explained to the public was sprung on the industry, despite earlier assurances that no final decisions would be made prior to detailed consultation. Nor did the tax, as designed, receive anything approaching consensus support from reform-minded economists, including those with specialist knowledge of resources taxation. Again, you don't have to take the word of the Minerals Council of Australia on this. Others, including Martin Ferguson, have placed on the record their dismay at the failure to consult and the divisive political agenda which accompanied the resource super profits tax. It wasn't the mining industry that tore up the reform rulebook, it was the government. Beyond interpretations of history, Professor Garnaut's normative model of economic reform also appears problematic. This includes the elevation over commercial society of what he calls the, quote, independent centre of the national polity, unquote. This construct begs more questions than it answers. Who decides on membership of the independent centre of the national polity? How should we think about the motives and interests of political actors and their advisers? Is the independent centre prone to any biases which may counterbalance or overwhelm its self-proclaimed virtues? And how does this tidy categorisation square with the benefits, both democratic and in policy terms, from competition in a free society over what constitutes the common good? In closing, I return to the three P's as offering a better, more humble and more durable guide to successful economic reform. Rather than assign standing in public debate based on arbitrary categories or where people work, surely the better place to start is to assess arguments against a traditional reformist paradigm. Is there evidence to suggest a given policy or regulation increases or decreases the capacity of our economy to produce valued goods and services? Does it help blow the pipes out, or does it clog them up? Ultimately, the same standard should apply to everyone, miners, anti-mining greens, and academics alike. Secondly, let's give politics its due, if for no other reason than to do otherwise is to let the politicians off the hook. Politics will never deliver against an absolute ideal, but then again, that's not why we value it. As Bernard Crick wrote in Defence of Politics, politics represents at least some tolerance of differing truths, some recognition that government is possible, indeed best conducted, amid the open canvassing of rival interests. To seek to suppress or banish interests in public life is not politics, it's the opposite. Still, we tend to know high political art when we see it, where politicians are able to act as a creative force, not mere intermediaries. And let's not forget Keynes's dictum that the power of interests in the policy process is vastly overstated compared with that of ideas. No one pretends economic reform is without political risk, but the reform era provides ample evidence of how calculated risks can bring their own rewards. For Paul Keating, it was just part of his style. Downhill, one ski, no poles. Albeit more cautious, John Howard has stated that while promising tax reform almost cost him office in 1998, it was also the essential ingredient of victory. And on process, I can do no better than look back to Gary Banks's last speech as chairman of the Productivity Commission. Having set out a long and compelling productivity agenda, he observed pointedly that good process in policy formulation, with proper testing of proposed solutions, including on the detail and with those most affected, is the most important thing of all on the to-do list. So can Australia get its reform mojo back? My Gen X conclusion is a tentative but hopeful one. We've been here before, we know what works, we just need to try it again. Thank you very much.
John, many thanks for a thoughtful speech. We're just having one adjustment here, and we'll come to questions and discussion in a minute. You want any water, John? Yeah, yes, you do. Holy water. Gin. Gin. Okay. Okay, thanks. Cheers. Okay, so we come to questions and discussion. John's going to have a glass of water, so we'll, in case Sky wants to cut, I'll start again. Okay, so we come to questions and discussion. John, if you just come back up here. You referred to this kind of issue in a sense of the good years, but I think it was also a motivation from the bad years, as I recall, and you will know. Bob Hawke and Paul Keating were determined not to repeat the disaster of the Whitlam government. John Howard was determined not to repeat the disappointment of the Fraser government. And then there were the recessions of the early 1970s, particularly the early 1980s, which was fresh in everyone's memory, and again in the early 1990s, which kind of propelled the reform. So to what extent is it that we simply that we haven't had a recession that... in many Australians' adult lifetime, and that some Australians just can't remember what one was really like.
Thanks, Gerard. I think there is certainly something in that. As I said, you know, it was pretty clear that the old model was exhausted. And I think you're right, Hawkes at least had a training in economics, so he was receptive to reform ideas. I think John Howard basically took the view of the Fraser government that it, or the coalition, if you like, that it won office again too quickly and hadn't internalised that the world had changed dramatically in the early 1970s. So I think there is a times factor, and I do think that the degree to which we've been successful has created its own degree of inertia. I think there's something in that. I guess that's in part, though, where I don't think we can let the politicians off the hook. I think in part, probably what you have seen with, if I might say so, the baby boomers compared to their predecessors, is that they haven't actually had to live and breathe and articulate these things through these years. And in part, I think that's probably allowed them to not grasp the nature of the paradigm. And to me, it does come back to clear thinking and clear language. If you're going to call everything a reform, then pretty quickly, and you've got a bureaucracy that's not going to say, hang on, you can't actually say that, there are trade-offs here. And, I mean, that's another issue of, we can talk about the quality of the bureaucracy, I think. But I think in general, the political culture has allowed policymakers to get away with too much without stopping them and saying, well, what are we actually doing here? Is there a trade-off? Is there a cost to doing this that's not seen elsewhere?
Thank you. Michael Burke. John, just standing back. Michael Burke. John, you recall Bob Hawke's view in 1983 that to achieve real economic reform, you need consensus, and he implemented that consensus with the unions and so on, and was granted consensus by the opposition, because what he was implementing was in fact their policy, or at least Howard's policy anyway. To what extent do you think that that is still a factor? I noticed you didn't mention it in your talk, particularly when you see that Howard's government managed, despite the absence of consensus, to achieve quite a few or continuation of reform. I mean, is consensus an essential element?
Look, I don't think it necessarily is absolutely... It obviously helps, but I don't necessarily think it's essential. I mean, there were periods, right? The 1980s can get a bit of a heroic gloss about it also in that context, and that there were clearly blind spots. There were clearly areas where there wasn't consensus between the government and the opposition. But this is where the art of political reform comes in, that you may have a blockage there, but you do something else there. At some point you might have to backflip on privatisation and you find a way to do it. So the process sort of muddled along. It wasn't this uniform, brilliant, heroic cycle that it can perhaps be portrayed, and I didn't really mean to portray that way itself. There's an awful lot of politics in the 1980s, as well as you know. So I don't think consensus is essential. I think it comes back to, if you like, the high art of where leaders are prepared to put their political capital and their capacity to explain it and to own it. And I think that that's been an area where we've sort of dropped the ball.
Do you have time down there?
John, thank you for a wonderful speech. You've provided some very interesting frames of reference for your case. One of the reforms that we haven't tackled as a community, amongst the many that you mentioned, is legal reform. In the context of, say, what Marcus Aurelius said in his Meditations, that the sovereign has to be totally aligned with the interests of the citizen, could you perhaps offer an insight as to why we haven't tackled that last reform in that frame?
Question about legal reform.
Can I just clarify, you're talking about the competitive nature of the legal profession, or what part of legal reform?
We're the third most litigious state in the world after, I think, California, and then Florida, and then it's New South Wales. Mm-hmm. That's a huge economic impost on the community, mm-hmm. and you could argue that it's useful to stop.
Yeah, look, and I know it's been quite a while, but I remember when I was at the Institute, actually, that the litigiousness, certainly of American society, was an issue that was a concern to us here when we were doing work at the Institute. I'm not a legal expert. I generally am optimistic that our political culture can avoid sort of excesses that the American system has had. I'm not sure we've... I mean, I take your point. I suspect we've probably, to a large extent, viewed things like legal reform through a professions or guild-type prism, not really about the economic cost of the legal system. And I think that's a good point. I don't think we've probably looked at it in any considered way in terms of an era of microeconomic reform. I don't have a good explanation as to why, though.
Question?
Jeff Dunstan, very thoughtful and thoroughly interesting talk. Not without some controversy in it, but we'll forget that. My question is that, based on IBIS and Phil Rivlin, the mining industry's productivity is the worst. I'll just give you a platform as to why.
Depends whether you're talking levels or growth rates. Growth rates, yes.
Productivity.
Productivity levels.
Per capita.
Hang on.
If you're talking value added per employee, it's very high. But there's certainly been, and in fact, if you look at international studies, certainly up to the millennium, mining was one of the few areas where Australia's relative productivity level was higher than other developed countries. But certainly the productivity slowdown since 2003, or broadly over the boom period, is quite dramatic. It's fallen by a third. And there's been quite a few studies as to what elements of that may be one-off or structural or temporary. One is purely the fact that ore grades have declined and continue to decline. So it just costs an awful lot of money to get the same amount of ore or metal out of the ground. Clearly there's a lag between a huge investment cycle and getting the actual product going, and that's part of it as well. I think there's also been, the one thing about the mining industry I'd say is that it's very strict in not wanting to compromise its health and safety record, and it's taken on a lot of employees probably who you might put in a category that have required a lot of extra supervision. I mean, that's in some sense anecdotal, but I think there's an element to that. So I think there are a whole host of reasons, but I'm not quite sure what particular metric or study you're referring to in terms of levels, because in terms of levels, mining is still a highly high productivity industry.
Question here.
Yes.
All right. John, you mentioned that you were 17 years old in 1983 and so forth. During that time, there was early 1980s, there was an oil crisis, everyone lining up to get their petrol, 21% interest rates, high inflation, and a national debt crisis, and everyone going broke. But at the time, there was a new US administration coming in with new reforms, liberating financial markets and everything, so savings and loans, so there won't be any bailout by governments, and less protectionism, lower taxes, and free trade agreement with Canada. And my question is that since then, the question is not really what is whether we're having economic reform, it's what is economic reform. The question is that our reform is really just following the US, which is basically...
Suggesting our reform is simply following the US.
Well, look, I don't really agree. I think Australia's got a pretty unique model in terms of trying to combine, if you like, efficiency and equity. And that's been, whilst there's a lot of disputation in a party political sense, in general, that model has been sustained, where you can actually do reform to improve the efficiency of the economy, but also at the same time look after the less privileged in the community. So I don't really buy the notion that we've just gone the American road. I never have. I think people's or countries' political cultures are very distinct and different. If anything, and I probably didn't believe this for a long time, but if anything, I think our political culture is still closer to Britain than it is to America.
Question here, and then we go to there. Yep.
Yes. Do you think that the with the decline in mining at the moment, and the sort of thoughts that come up, like will we another Silicon Valley, or maybe we'll be the breadbasket of Asia, would be sort of a possible solution? Or is our situation similar to the 1890s depression, when mining's out of the picture and things are going downhill, and all you've got left is agriculture?
Look, I don't think it is similar. I mean, it's interesting that people say the mining boom is over and we can't put all our eggs in one basket, I think is a favourite saying of the Prime Minister. We're still largely a services economy. Services make up a good 70% of the economy anyway. So, and agriculture actually is a very low percentage. So in some ways the nature of where we are in 2013, just in terms of our structure, is quite different from the 1890s. In terms of the investment cycle, there's no doubt it'll have to decline. It was at a historic high, 8% of GDP, and there's no way that could have been sustained. I think the interesting thing now is to what extent it declines and whether policymakers are trying to, if you like, smooth that in some way or counter the pressures for decline. I'm generally optimistic that as long as you maintain a flexible, adaptable economy with skilled people, that you will find different sources of growth. The mining industry won't collapse overnight, it'll go through cycles, but there's still an awful lot of potential growth in terms of emerging Asian economies. Similarly, for agriculture, there's potential there. I was reminded recently, I did a talk at ANU about Barry Jones's Knowledge Nation exercise for Kim Beazley. And basically, in 2001, he said, you know, we've got to get out of mining. It's this declining commodity-based industry with declining terms of trade. You know, we've got to follow the path of Europe on this, that and the other. That was precisely 2 years before the China boom took off. So all I would say, which is sort of in keeping with the theme of my talk, is don't get too hung up about what the experts might say has to be the next growth phase.
Rory. John, what would an appropriate and sensible mining tax look like? The background here being that, you know, Mark I mining tax was a disaster for the previous Rudd government, you know, PM was rolled. It was a disaster. Mark II was a disaster for the federal budget because not much revenue was raised. If you sort of, the analogy might be with the wholesale sales tax system in the olden days that was converted into a uniform GST consumption tax. Here we've got a state-based royalty system with different amounts and different percentages for different resources across different states. Is there a case for making that uniform? And, you know, if you accept that the resources on the ground are owned by the Australian people and there should be a resources charge to be paid by the mining companies before the resources are sold to foreigners, what would that resources charge look like if it was appropriate and sensible?
That's a big and interesting question, Rory. I'd have to say on behalf of our industry there's a fair bit of tax exhaustion based on the chopping and changing that's been seen in recent times. It does get back to being very careful in terms of what you think the state of play is. So, yes, in a broad sense, they're owned by the Australian people, but they are owned by the states, which is really where we started the Henry exercise. The MCA's public submission put on record that conceptually and in theory a profits-based regime was appropriate. But then it starts to get interesting, and only then do you have to then sit down with industry, with state governments who obviously care about having a stable royalty stream, revenue stream in terms of royalties. I think the problem really is that basically what was said to industry is that the current system is unsustainable. You know, you've got seven higgledy-piggledy royalty regimes and we need to do something about it. Well, we ended up with seven higgledy-piggledy royalty regimes and another tax. So, and the other point I'd make, I think, is that you really need to look at this in terms of the long-term profitability of the industry. Whilst there was a period of what you might call rents, nobody is making rents in the coal industry today. There's about 11,000 job losses. So I think there are a whole host of... I mean, the circumstances are different. The issue of tax reform will come back, undoubtedly, again. Tony Abbott said he will have a... If he should he win government, have a tax reform process. The Minerals Council would be part of a future process, but it would be part of a process conditioned by what the last experience has been.
Question down there. Yeah. Yes, Olga, if you could explain to me why there is the, in the singleton situation where they're going to have to fly in, fly out, instead of having, when there's already a miners there, that why do not the singleton miners just accept the same terms and conditions as the fly in, fly outs? And this is again indicative of industrial reform that's not happening.
Look, I won't pretend to comment in detail about that episode. I think my colleagues at the New South Wales Minerals Council would be more across that. In terms of the industry, there's certainly this difficult issue of what is inevitably a cyclical industry, as to where you basically say the objective is in terms of investment. So on the one hand, the mining industry sort of gets castigated by for not sort of investing in local towns and using fly-in, fly-out. At the same time, they're usually the same people who say that the mining boom's going to end tomorrow and okay, so you want us to plough decades of investment into a place that you don't think is going to last anyway. The other point about fly-in, fly-out that I would simply make is that the research we've done is... Now, look, there's no doubt that there are issues in certain cases, but basically people, about up to 90% of the workforce that use fly-in, fly-out actually want to do that because they want to keep their families close to capital cities, to services that are there, to schools that their kids might be at. So, look, it's a complex area. I generally just trust the capacity for companies to have to work it out on the ground. I don't think in particular having, you know, Canberra do inquiries into fly-in, fly-out and issuing edicts is the best way to go. I think, in general, it does take goodwill on the part of companies who have to understand their social license to operate, to work with local communities, to try to do what they can to ensure that activity is sustainable, that the footprint, if you like, is reflected, that there are appropriate areas of government financing also in terms of whether it be fiscal equalisation across the Commonwealth or particular formulas that local governments use. I mean, there needs to be a sort of a joined-up response to these issues to ensure that local councils can actually deal with the pressures where they are.
You mentioned... Oh, Anne, yes.
John, I lived through it all too, a little bit ahead of you, the 80s and 90s. But there was a worldwide movement about economic reform, and a lot of this stuff started, you know, in the 20s in Australia. There were people, the economists saying that we're living off the sheep's back and blah, 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 and had protection. There was a huge amount of change, and it was a world sort of thing. Where do we take off for the next bit? We've had work choices. We've got people now underemployed rather than unemployed. We've got older people helping younger people. There's a whole different scenario. So where does the next jumping off spot come?
Look, I think we probably are past the era of big bang reforms, and that's partly what I said. In some sense, you can only do certain things once. And that's why if you look at Gary Banks' last speech as chairman of the Productivity Commission, it's a long list of tough things that have been put to one side, none of which are huge big bang. And in a sense, that's where he gets to in the end by saying, let's just start by having good process on these things and we can start to make progress. I think what the part of the problem that's afflicted our industry in some sense is that we're still actually, to quote Paul Keating, putting more crap in the pipes rather than let's just do no harm for a while and then start to see where we can improve situations. So if you take, for example, it's only a year ago that we had a budget that was spreading the benefits of the boom. Earlier this year, you had more sort of jobs packages, which were basically saying to companies, you know, you have to buy local and adding yet more regulation. The fact is the world has already changed on that. So we're still dealing with the political outcrop of a mentality of, you know, what can I get out of the mining industry? And I think at some point it does require political leaders to start to re-educate the public that there is no such thing as a free lunch. And until we do that, it will get harder. And that's where I agree with Ross. I mean, I agree with Garno that the next decade will be much tougher than the one that's gone, and I agree with him that people are going to have to start to come to terms with that sooner rather than later.
Second last question, Ian, off the back.
John, regardless of whether there's a change of government or not in the months ahead, would you like to comment on what the most pressing areas of reform require in the economy, not necessarily from the Minerals Council perspective?
Sure. I mean, I think at some point, an Australian government will have to look in a holistic way at the labour market operations again. If we are going into a more difficult phase of structural adjustment where, rather than just structural adjustment with sort of lollies dropping off the back of a truck in some way, it's structural adjustment into a more demanding economic environment. And I think in some sense, I think something like a Productivity Commission inquiry into the workplace relations will be essential at some point in the future. I think there is work in terms of regulation generally, red tape and green tape. I think there's an area of streamlining of environmental regulation, which, again, about 12 months ago, the feds and the states were actually moving in that direction, and then it got politicised and fallen off by the wayside. I think there is progress there. There's actually a lot that's gone on underneath prior to that short-circuiting. So I think some of that can go forward, and some of that can go forward depending, you know, not reliant on the outcome of the election. I mean, I think areas like education and training reform will always be there. I would hope to think that we're getting reform bang from the buck that may be spent in these areas, but it's a hope at the moment. I just don't know. But I think if you think ultimately that there's a large part of society that do need to be upskilled for a very rapidly changing world, then making sure our education and training institutions are doing, you know, the right thing is just always going to be there. And some of that I think you have to give credit to certainly former Prime Minister Gillard and the changes she did there. But it needs to be genuine reform rather than just spending money, otherwise, because increasingly it's money we haven't got.
Final question. You mentioned Barry Jones and Knowledge Nation just over a decade ago saying that there's no point Australia going on with mining, and then 10 years later there's a recognition that mining sort of got us through the global financial crisis without the recession due to the China boom. But if you go into, forget just leaving aside the green movement, and if you go into many universities and the social sciences, there are calls to close down the coal industry, to clamp down on the mining industry. I mean, how do you take on this anti-mining, anti-business attitude that seems to be more prevalent, not in the Labour and the Liberal and National parties, but in other parts of the public debate?
Yeah, I guess I'd perhaps not necessarily specifically about mining, but it's certainly been an issue that we at the Minerals Council have looked at and done some research into in terms of just the, if you like, disassociation of a larger part of the community with just business and if you like, the market economy in general. So I think there's an issue there for business as a whole. Now, I think it arguably went further in New Zealand, but it seems to me John Key's actually been able to build, again, in their own way, with their own political culture, a sort of a moderate revival of a more of a business engagement in the community there. I think there are parts of Australia where it's a real issue, where, if you like, reliance on government as a source of living standards and wealth has meant that there's this disassociation with the business community. I mean, getting back to generations, I don't know, Jared. You're probably closer to the younger generation than I am, based on your experiences. I think, you certainly hear lots of anecdotes from people in the mining industry saying how they end up having, you know, screaming matches with their niece over over this, that and the other. And I think the last time, or one of the recent institute functions I was at, was a very good function with Tony Smith and Andrew Lee. But the point I made there is was about my nine-year-old, who sort of seemed to me the first thing he learned at school was recycling, not actually reading. And so, look, I don't want to sound like a grumpy old man, but I do hope that our education institutions are teaching reading, writing and arithmetic first.
Many thanks.
Very brief. John has played an important role in the economic debate, but he brings a particular perspective because he's an economist with a PhD and a published author, but he's worked in the public service, he's worked with the opposition party, he's worked in government. So that's quite a perspective. And now with the Minerals Council of Australia in Canberra in a different kind of advocacy role. We're very grateful for your perspective tonight on economic reform. You've worked through a lot of it. You know a lot about it. Tonight's talk has certainly been provocative, which is why there's been so much interest. Well done, and no doubt you'll be back again not long in the future, but for tonight, well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.